Although repeatedly mentioned in the family conference, Bort was absent, but presumably still alive. It is not known if she heard of what went on among her sons, and no reliable information exists on exactly what happened to her. Oral tradition maintains that during this time she continued to live in the beautiful steppe at Avraga on the Herlin River, only a few days' ride from where she and her husband had lived in the first days of their marriage. She likely died there, or in the vicinity, sometime between 1219 and 1224. The unpleasant episode cast a pall over the remaining years of Genghis Khan's life, and particularly over the Central Asian campaign. The fighting among his sons made him keenly aware of how much work he needed to do to preserve the empire after his death. His sons did not match up to the needs of the empire. While pursuing his great quest to unite the steppe tribes and conquer every threat around him, he had never devoted the attention he should have to his sons, and now they were all reaching middle age and were still unproven men. In his mistrust of his own relatives and his lifelong reliance on his companions and friends from youth, he had not built a working relationship among his own sons, nor trained them to replace him. Throughout his final years of life, Genghis Khan sought, without success, to mend the relations between Joch and Chagatai by assigning them to a joint campaign against the city of Urgench, a former capital of the Sultan south of the Aral Sea. The tension seething between the two brothers nearly erupted into fighting against each other during the siege. Both brothers knew that the city would belong to Joch as a part of his patrimony, and because of this, they could not agree on the tactics to conquer it. Joch suspected that because Urgench would belong to him, his brother was trying to destroy it utterly. Chagatai, in turn, suspected that Joch's greed made him want to protect the buildings and structures of the city, even at the risk of killing more Mongol soldiers. Whereas most cities had fallen in a matter of days or weeks, the Mongol conquest of Urgench required an unprecedented 6 months. The city's defenders fought fiercely. Even after the Mongols broke through the city walls, the defenders continued to fight from house to house. Uncomfortable with fighting in the claustrophobic confines of a nearly destroyed city, the Mongols set fires to burn down the city. The defenders continued fighting from the charred ruins. Finally, the Mongols built a dam, diverted the river, and flooded the city, thereby killing the remaining warriors and destroying nearly everything in it. Urgench never rose again. And although allotted to Joch, nothing remained there for him and his descendants to rule over. Angry with the quarreling between his sons, Genghis Khan summoned them, momentarily ostracized them by refusing to admit them to the court. Then, when he finally admitted them, alternately berated, scolded, and pleaded with them. More conversations and quotes survive from this phase of Genghis Khan's life than any other, and they show a growing concern but lessening power to control his family. After too long a neglect of their education, he tried to teach his sons everything at once, and in doing so, he struggled to articulate lessons he had learned and ideas he had but had not verbalized clearly. He was accustomed to giving orders, not making explanations. He tried to teach them that the first key to leadership was self-control, particularly the mastery of pride, which was something more difficult, he explained, to subdue than a wild lion, and anger, which was more difficult to defeat than the greatest wrestler. He warned them that if you can't swallow your pride, you can't lead. He admonished them never to think of themselves as the strongest or smartest. Even the highest mountain had animals that step on it, he warned. when the animals climb to the top of the mountain, they are even higher than it is. In keeping with the laconic Mongol traditions, he warned his sons not to talk too much. Only say what needs to be said. A leader should demonstrate his thoughts and opinions through his actions, not through his words. He can never be happy until his people are happy. He stressed to them the importance of vision, goals, and a plan. Without the vision of a goal, a man cannot manage his own life, much less the lives of others. He told them. Some thoughts seemed to contradict others. As much as he emphasized the importance of seizing the mantle of leadership, he seemingly sought to impart cautious conservatism, in that the vision should never stray far from the teaching of the elders. As he explained it, the old tunic, or deal, fits better and is always more comfortable. It survives the hardships of life in the bush, while the new or untried deal is quickly torn. In keeping with his own sober manner and simple style of living, Genghis Khan warned them against the pursuit of a colorful life with material frivolities and wasteful pleasures. It will be easy, he explained, to forget your vision and purpose once you have fine clothes, fast horses, and beautiful women. In that case, you will be no better than a slave, and you will surely lose everything. In one of his most important lessons, he told his sons that conquering an army is not the same as conquering a nation. You may conquer an army with superior tactics and men, but you can conquer a nation only by conquering the hearts of the people. As idealistic as that sounded, he followed with the even more practical advice that even though the Mongol Empire should be one, the subject people should never be allowed to unite as one. People conquered on different sides of the lake should be ruled on different sides of the lake. Like so many of his teachings, this too would be ignored by his sons and their successors. The Mongol conquest stopped at the city of Multan, in the center of modern-day Pakistan, in the summer of 1222, the year of the horse. After descending from the mountains of Afghanistan onto the plains of the Indus River earlier that year, Genghis Khan had considered conquering all of northern India, circling around south of the Himalayas and heading north across the Sung territory of China. Such a plan well suited the Mongol sensibility that one should never return by exactly the same route that one came. However, the geography and climate stopped him. As soon as the Mongols left the dry and colder region of the mountains, both warriors and horses weakened and grew sick. Even more alarming, the Mongol bows that were so well adapted to the extreme cold and heat of the steppe homeland also weakened in the damp air and seemed to lose the powerful accuracy that made the Mongol warrior such a dreaded shot. Facing these obstacles, Genghis Khan headed back into the mountains in February, and despite the tremendous loss of lives among the prisoners who cleared the snow-filled passes, he took his army to more comfortable and colder terrain. He left behind 2 Tumen, some 20,000 men, to continue the India campaign. But by summer, illness and heat had so depleted their ranks that the survivors withdrew and limped back to the benign and healthful environment of Afghanistan. Despite the aborted invasion of India, the campaign had achieved its main goals of conquering the Khwarezm Empire and bringing Central Asia and much of the Middle East under Mongol control. Before leaving the newly conquered lands, Genghis Khan called for a celebration that featured what was probably the largest hunt in history. During months of preparation during the winter of 1222 to 1223, his men cordoned off a large area by planting posts in the ground and stringing long pieces of horsehair twine between them. They hung strips of felt on the twine, and when the wind blew, as it almost always did, it frightened the animals away from the edges and toward the center of the area. At the appointed time, different armies began to converge on the area from different directions. Tens of thousands of soldiers took part in the ensuing hunt, which lasted for several months. They bagged all manner of animals, from rabbits and birds to large herds of gazelle, antelope, and wild asses. The hunt was part celebration, but it also seemed an effort to use the conviviality of the hunts and the entertainment that followed them to mellow relations among his sons, soothe over the hot-headed anger of the battlefield, and end the campaigns on a cooperative note, still smarting from the wounds inflicted by his brothers, and apparently alienated from his father as well. George, the most beloved of the sons, claimed to be ill and refused to come even when summoned by direct order of Genghis Khan. Relations between the father and son nearly erupted into armed conflict when Genghis Khan heard that the supposedly ill George had organized rival hunts in a celebration for his men. The father and son never met again. Instead of returning to Mongolia, George stayed in the newly conquered territory. He would soon die there, leaving as much mystery surrounding his death as his birth. The timing of his death, while his father still lived, sparked rumors that Genghis Khan may have killed George in order to ensure political peace among his sons and for the Mongol Empire. But as with so many parts of Mongol history, only the rumors survived, without convincing evidence one way or another. Despite the tensions within Genghis Khan's family, for most Mongols, the victorious return of the army marked a high point in their lives. The triumphant spirit of the group hunt was continued throughout the long trek back to Mongolia, where the mood of pride and success erupted in a joyous homecoming and victory celebration, or Nadam. Long caravans of captives preceded the main part of Genghis Khan's army. For nearly 5 years, a steady flow of camel caravans lumbered out of the Muslim lands carrying packs of looted goods to Mongolia, where the population eagerly awaited each load of exotic luxuries. Mongol girls, who had spent their days milking goats and yaks when the army left, soon wore garments of silk and gold, while their newly acquired servants milked the animals for them. Old people, who had rarely seen metal in their childhood, cut meat with knives of engraved Damascus steel set in handles of sculpted ivory, and they served irak from silver bowls while their musicians sang to them. Although Genghis Khan was once again in the land that he loved, he could hardly stop to rest before setting out on another campaign. Perhaps knowing that he was nearing the end of his life, he did not have time to stop, or perhaps he realized that his empire depended upon constant conquest. If he paused, factionalism within his own family threatened to rip the empire apart. Probably even more pressing, his followers had grown dependent on a steady flow of goods. They would not willingly return to the simple goods that he had known as a child. In order to feed this voracious appetite, he had to move on to new conquests. He launched the final campaign in his long life against the Tangut, the first foreign enemies he had invaded in 1207, the year following the creation of the Mongol Empire. Despite their initial surrender, Genghis Khan had nourished a lingering grudge against their Khan for refusing to furnish troops for the Khwarizm invasion. The Tangut king smugly sent word that if Genghis Khan could not defeat Khwarizm alone, then he should not go to war. Although irritated, Genghis Khan kept his immediate focus on the Khwarizm campaign. But once finished with it, he turned back toward the Tangut. As he again moved his army south, he almost certainly had plans for yet one more major campaign in which the Tangut War would only be an opening move. He probably intended to secure a base in the Tangut Kingdom and then move on south toward the final goal of the Sung Dynasty, a prize that had eluded the army he had left fighting in northern China when he invaded Khorasim. During the winter of 1226 to 1227, while en route across the Gobi to make war on the Tangut, Genghis Khan paused to hunt wild horses. He rode a reddish-gray horse that shied when the wild horses charged him, and the skittish horse threw the great Khan to the ground. Despite internal injuries, a raging fever, and the concerned advice of his wife Yesu, Genghis Khan refused to return home and instead pressed on with the Tangut campaign. Although his health never recovered after the fall, he continued the campaign against the Tangut king, whose name, by an odd coincidence, was Burhan, which meant God, as in the sacred mountain Burhan Haldun. The name was so sacred to Genghis Khan that once he defeated the Tangut, he ordered that the king's name be changed before he was executed. 6 months later, and only a few days before the final victory over the Tangut, Genghis Khan died. The secret history states clearly that he died at the end of summer, but although the text describes in great detail each horse that he rode, it falls suddenly silent regarding the circumstances of his death. Other sources maintain that when death finally arrived, his Tatar wife Yesu prepared the body for burial in a simple way, befitting the manner in which Genghis Khan had lived. Attendants cleaned and dressed the body in a plain white robe, felt boots, and a hat, then wrapped it in a white felt blanket filled with sandalwood, the valuable aromatic wood that repelled insects and infused the body with a pleasant perfume. They bound the felt coffin with three golden straps. On the third day, a procession set out toward Mongolia with the great Khan's body on a simple cart. The spirit banner of Genghis Khan led the mourners, followed by a woman shaman, and behind her followed a horse with a loose bridle and Genghis Khan's empty saddle. It is difficult to imagine what kind of image Genghis Khan thought he was leaving to the world. Only a small hint of how he saw himself can be found in the chronicle of Minhaj al-Siraj Jujjani, who called Genghis Khan accursed and described his death as his descent into hell. Yet Jujjani recorded a conversation that an imam claimed to have had with the infamous conqueror. The cleric served in Genghis Khan's court, and at least according to his own boastful claim, became a special favorite of the Mongol Khan. One day, during a conversation, Genghis Khan supposedly said, "A mighty name will remain behind me in the world." With some hesitation, the imam told Genghis Khan that he was killing so many people that there might not be anyone left to remember his name. The Khan did not like this response and told the cleric, "It has become evident to me that you do not possess complete understanding, and that your comprehension is but small. There are many kings in the world," he explained to the learned man. In reference to his future reputation, he added that there are many more people in other parts of the world, and many more sovereigns and many more kingdoms. Genghis Khan confidently declared, "They will relate my story." We find an unusual and more informative glimpse into the mind of Genghis Khan and into his image of himself near the end of his life, which survives in the text of a letter Genghis Khan sent to a Taoist monk in China, a copy of which was made by some of the old monk's followers. Unlike the secret history, which mostly records deeds and spoken words, this letter recorded Genghis Khan's analysis of himself. Although the letter is available to us only in the form written in classical Chinese by a scribe, almost certainly one of the Hitan traveling with the Mongol court, the sentiments and perceptions of Genghis Khan himself come out quite clearly in the document. His voice comes through as simple, clear, and informed by common sense. He ascribed the fall of his enemies more to their own lack of ability than to his superior prowess. "I have not myself distinguished qualities." He said that the eternal blue sky had condemned the civilizations around him because of their haughtiness and their extravagant luxury. Despite the tremendous wealth and power he had accumulated, he continued to lead a simple life. "I wear the same clothing and eat the same food as the cowherds and horseherders. We make the same sacrifices, and we share the riches." He offered a simple assessment of his ideals. "I hate luxury, and I exercise moderation." He strove to treat his subjects like his children, and he treated talented men like his brothers, no matter what their origin was. He described his relations with his officials as being close and based on respect. "We always agree in our principles, and we are always united in mutual affection." Although he sent the letter on the eve of his invasion of the Muslim world, and it was written in Chinese, he clearly did not see himself as the heir of kingdoms or cultural traditions in either area. He acknowledged only one preceding empire from which he personally took inspiration: his ancestors, the Huns. It is clear that he did not wish to rule in either the Muslim or the Chinese style. He wanted to find his own way, as befitted a steppe empire descended from the Huns. He claimed that his victories had been possible only through the assistance of the eternal blue sky. "But as my calling is high, the obligations incumbent on me are also heavy." He did not, however, feel that he had been as successful in peace as he had been in war. "I fear that in my ruling there may be something wanting." He said that good officials over the state are as important as a good rudder to a boat. While he managed to find men of talent to serve as his generals, he admitted he had, unfortunately, not been able to find men as good in administration. Most important, the letter shows a shift in the political thinking of Genghis Khan. After admitting to his shortcomings, Genghis Khan nevertheless shows in this document a rising sense of himself and his mission on earth. He had begun his campaign against the Jurchid, his first major campaign beyond the steppe, as a series of raids for plunder, but by the end of it, he had installed a vassal state. His words reveal a deeper and wider plan than mere raiding and controlling trade networks. He acknowledged that he went south to accomplish something that no one else in history had done. He was pursuing a great work because he sought to unite the whole world in one empire. He was no longer a tribal chief, and now he sought to be the ruler of all people and all lands, from where the sun rises to where the sun sets. Perhaps the most fitting description of Genghis Khan's passing was penned in the 18th century by Edward Gibbon, the British historian of the Romans and a great scholar on the history of empires and conquest. He wrote simply that Genghis Khan died in the fullness of years and glory, with his last breath, exhorting and instructing his sons to achieve the conquest of the Chinese Empire. To fulfill the wishes and commands of Genghis Khan, there still remained much to be done.
Audible Inc. presents Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. Written by Jack Weatherford. Narrated by Jonathan Davis. With an introduction read by the author, Jack Weatherford.
Chapter 6, The Discovery and Conquest of Europe. For our sins, unknown tribes came. Chronicle of Novgorod, 1224. In the spirit of inebriated generosity, at the celebration of his installation as Great Khan, Ogode threw open his father's treasury and riotously distributed all the riches stored there. He passed out pearls, the gem most admired by the Mongols, by the casket loads. Bolts of silk cloth were thrown out among the people. Horses and camels were decorated in great finery, and all the Mongols had new silk deals embroidered with golden threads. They had so many beautiful colors that each day the courtiers could all wear the same color, and then the next day a different color was prescribed. They drank, feasted, and played games throughout the summer of 1229 at Avraga, where storehouses had been erected to serve as a treasury for some of the tremendous amount of loot sent back from Genghis Khan's campaigns. The days of blue and green and white and yellow silks rolled one into the other, as the most powerful family in the world celebrated itself. To lubricate the event, the alcohol flowed without pause. Men and women drank until they passed out. They slept a while, and then resumed drinking when they awoke. About this time, the family took on the name of the Golden Family, or Golden Lineage. Gold symbolized royalty for the steppe people, but it could just have easily represented the vast wealth that the family held, and that they quickly began to use up. Without Genghis Khan to moderate the celebration, his heirs now ruled the empire, drunk with riches they had not earned, and with the alcohol that they had come to love. The drunken revelry of Ogode Khan's inauguration set the standard and the model for his rule, and at least momentarily, it controlled the spirit of the empire as well. As Atamalik Juveni wrote soon thereafter, Ogode was ever spreading the carpet of merrymaking and treading the path of excess in constant appreciation to wine and the company of beautiful women. In the interim after Genghis Khan's death, and during the Mongol distraction with the celebration of Ogode's election, some of the newly conquered subjects broke away and stopped sending tribute. Ogode had to send large armies back into northern China and Central Asia to reassert Mongol dominance. As soon as he was installed in 1230, he sent a force of 3 tumens, nearly 30,000 soldiers, to strengthen the Mongol hold on Central Asia. But most of the wealth had already been taken. He sent in an occupying army, one that even took its families along, not a conquering one. The level of tribute remitted back to Mongolia from both northern China and Central Asia, however, remained modest compared to the wealth taken in the original looting. Ogode did not accompany his army. Conquest was not his priority. As part of his enjoyment of his empire, Ogode decided that, like all great sovereigns, he should have a permanent capital city. Not just a collection of gurs, but real buildings with walls and roofs, windows and doors. Contrary to the thinking of his father, Ogode had become convinced that a kingdom conquered on horseback could not be ruled on horseback, when, of course, rule from horseback and a mobile center of power had in fact been one of the primary factors behind Mongol success. In the first of several bad mistakes, in what would be a short reign, Ogode abandoned this policy and tried to create a fixed center of power and administration for the empire. Since the old homeland on the Onon and Hurlan rivers now belonged, as was the Mongol custom, to Tolu, the youngest son, Ogode decided to build his capital on his own territory farther west. He chose an area in the middle of the Mongol lands on the Orhan River in the territory that had earlier belonged to Ong Khan's Karayid tribe, and before that had been the capital of the early Turkic kingdoms. He chose the site according to the nomadic standards for a good camp. It was on an open steppe, with good wind to keep down mosquitoes, with ample water, far enough away that it would not be polluted by the people living in the city, and with mountains nearby as a winter sanctuary for the herds. In all these regards, the site of Karakorum, as it came to be known, was perfect. The only problem being that a city with a permanent population has much different requirements than a good but temporary camp. They needed a constant supply of food throughout the year, and without any way of producing it, the city would be constantly dependent on goods brought at great expense from hundreds of miles south of the Gobi. Its location on the open steppe provided no shelter from the extremely bitter winter wind. Unlike the herd that could withdraw to the protection of the mountains, the city could not be so easily relocated each season. These problems would plague and ultimately doom this Mongol capital. Ogedev probably began construction of his palace in a typically Mongol style by shooting an arrow across the steppe and then building the first wing following the arrow shot. In keeping with the Mongol system of measuring space, the building stretched the length of a standard bow shot. He built another wing in the same way, and placed a tall pavilion in the middle to connect them. He built a sturdy wall to enclose the palaces, and from these walls the place acquired the name of Karakorum, meaning black stones or black walls. Rashid al-Din described Ogedev's new palace as exceedingly tall in structure and with lofty pillars, such as was in keeping the high resolve of such a king. The craftsmen finished the buildings by painting them with colorful designs and pictures. The Mongols continued to live in their gurs around Karakorum as they had in the open steppe. The royal court moved from area to area with the seasons, often several days or a week's journey away from the capital. Chinese architects and craftsmen designed and built the structures of Karakorum, but the private palace Ogedev built for his family at Kerchagan, a day's ride from Karakorum, was in the Muslim style. Unlike other world capitals that functioned as showpieces for the power, grandeur, and majesty of the ruling family, Karakorum served primarily as a large warehouse and workshop, ignored by most Mongols, including Ogedev, through most of the year. They used it as a base where they kept their goods, and their goods included craftsmen who worked for them. The city produced little, but it collected tribute from across the empire. One-third of the city was reserved to house the newly recruited clerks needed to run the empire. These included scribes and translators from every nation in the empire so that they could manage the correspondence with each country. The oldest visitor's account we have of the city comes from Juveni, who described a garden enclosed within a compound with a gate facing each of the cardinal directions. Within the garden, Chinese artisans built a castle with doors like the gates of the garden, and inside it a throne having three flights of steps, one for Ogedev alone, another for his ladies, and a third for the cupbearers and table deckers. In front of the palace, Ogedev built a series of lakes, wherein many waterfowl used to gather. He would watch the hunting of these birds and afterward would give himself up to the joys of drinking. As befitted a man so fond of alcohol, the centerpiece of the palace complex was a series of gold and silver vats so large that he reportedly kept camels and elephants on hand, so that when a public feast was held, they might lift up the various beverages. In addition to the palaces for himself and other members of the Golden Family, Ogedev erected several houses of worship for his Buddhist, Muslim, Taoist, and Christian followers. Of these, the Christians seemed to be gaining dominance at the Mongol court, because Ogedev, like his three brothers, had taken Christian wives when they conquered the Caryid and Naaman, and some of his descendants were Christian, particularly his favorite grandson, Shiramun. The Mongol version of the biblical name Solomon. Part of the attraction of the Mongols to Christianity seemed to be in the name of Jesus, Yesu, which sounded like the Mongolian word for nine, their sacred number, and the name of Genghis Khan's father, Yesuge, who was the founder of the whole dynasty. Despite the high status of Christians, the small city of Karakorum was probably the most religiously open and tolerant city in the world at that time. Nowhere else could followers of so many different religions worship side by side in peace. To encourage trade caravans to seek out his new capital, Ogode paid extremely high prices for all manner of goods, whether he needed them or not, and whether they were of high or low quality. Rashid al-Din wrote that Ogode would sit every day after he had finished his meal on a chair outside his court, where every kind of merchandise that is to be found in the world was heaped up in piles. These wares he used to give away to all classes of Mongols and Muslims, and it would often happen that he would command persons of great size to take as many of the wares they wanted as they could lift up. In addition to animals and a variety of foods, merchants arrived with loads of textiles, ivory tusks, pearls, hunting falcons, golden goblets, jeweled belts, willow-whip handles, cheetahs, bows and arrows, garments, hats, and exotic animal horns. People also came to entertain, including actors and musicians from China, wrestlers from Persia, and a jester from Byzantium. Ogode Khan frequently paid twice the asking price for imported goods as a show of appreciation for the effort the merchant made in reaching his realm and as an inducement for other merchants to do the same. Ogode also decreed that whatever price the merchants asked should be paid to them plus a 10% bonus. The Mongols also provided the capital backing to finance caravans when needed. In an effort to improve trade, Ogode introduced a standardized system of weights and measures to replace the various types used in different countries and cities. Because bullion and coins proved so bulky to transport, the Mongols created a system of paper money exchanges that made trade much easier and safer. Ogode's army managed to reassert Mongol rule in Central Asia, and under the able leadership of old General Subude, allied with the Sung dynasty to pick apart the remaining wealth and land of the Jurchid. His father had kept a steady supply of goods coming by living in the field at war and shipping home the loot. Ogode, however, increasingly used the might of his army to make the routes safe for merchants to bring in more goods. He stationed permanent garrisons to protect the roads and merchants, and he abolished the complex system of local taxes and extortion that had added to the difficulty and expense of trade. The Mongols planted trees along the sides of roads to shade the travelers in summer and to mark the road during winter snows. In areas where trees would not grow, they erected stone pillars to mark the way. Juveni stated that the Mongol roads were to ensure that wherever profit or gain was displayed, in the uttermost west or the farthermost east, thither merchants would bend their steps. The dismounting of Ogode at Karakorum and the building of stone walls so hated by his father marked a major step away from the policies of Genghis Khan. Thereby began a process of co-optation that over the next four decades transformed the Mongols from a nation of mounted warriors to a sedentary court, with all the trappings of civilized decadence that was so contrary to Genghis Khan's legacy. By 1235, Ogode had squandered most of his father's wealth. Ogode's city was expensive to build and operate, and his habits expensive to meet. Tribute still poured in from across the empire, but it did not come in quite the volume of his father's day. No matter what he did to build a capital or reform the administration, in the end, the Mongol Empire rested on conquest. He desperately needed an infusion of wealth to continue in the lifestyle to which he and the Mongols had become accustomed. The Mongol people grew no crops and manufactured no products, and they were loath to trade away the horses that they bred in such copious numbers. If the Mongol Empire were to survive, Ogedei had to take them to war against a new target, one that had not yet been looted. But which and where? To decide the targets of future conquest, Ogedei summoned a Hurultai to the steps near his newly built capital of Karakorum. Each participant seemed to support a different course of action. Some wanted the army to head south into the vast subcontinent of India that Genghis Khan had merely glimpsed from the northern mountains, but had declined to invade because of its wretched heat. Others advocated a prolonged push farther into Persia, and then on to the fabled Arab cities of Baghdad and Damascus. And still others advocated a full-scale assault on the Sung, with whom the Mongols had recently been allies of convenience. One man, however, had a different proposal. Subhudev, fresh from his victory over the Jurchid, had been the greatest general in Genghis Khan's army, and with his shrewd knowledge of siege warfare and the use of large attack machines, he had played a major role in every important campaign the Mongols had fought. He was now 60 years old, probably blind in one eye, and according to some reports, so fat that he could no longer ride a horse and had to be hauled around in an iron chariot. Despite these physical limitations, his mind was sharp and vigorous, and he was eager to return to war. Rather than returning to fight against the Muslim or Chinese armies over which he had many victories, Subhudev favored a break with the policies of Genghis Khan by organizing a massive campaign to the west, toward Europe, a previously unknown civilization that he had recently discovered quite by accident. He insisted that like China, India, and the Muslim countries, Europe also held the promise of great wealth. Subhudev had tested the European armies, and he knew how they fought and how easily they could be defeated. For most of the participants in the Hurultai, Europe was a great unknown. Subhudev was the only surviving commander who had been there, and he had originally probed it with only a small force. His discovery of Europe happened more than a decade earlier in 1221, during Genghis Khan's invasion of Central Asia, when Subhudev and Jeb had circled the Caspian in pursuit of the Khwarizm Sultan. After the Sultan's death, they asked and received permission to continue to see what lay to the north. There they discovered the small Christian kingdom of Georgia, ruled by Georgi III, the Brilliant. Jeb led the probe of their defenses. After centuries of warfare with the Muslims around it, Georgia boasted a highly skilled and professional army. And operating on their home territory, the defenders moved out to meet the attacking Mongols, as they had met numerous Turkic and Muslim armies before them. Jeb's Mongols charged the Georgians, fired a few volleys, and then turned to flee in what appeared to the Georgians to be a panicked rout. But of course, it was no more than the dogfight strategy of the feigned retreat. The overconfident Georgian forces broke ranks and began to eagerly chase the Mongols, who barely managed to stay ahead of their pursuers. The Georgian horses gradually began to tire under their heavy loads and the strain of the long pursuit. They began to thin out as the weaker ones fell farther behind. Then, suddenly, with the Georgian forces spread out and beginning to tire, Jeb's retreating warriors led them straight into the ranks of the other Mongol regiment waiting under Subhudev's command. While Subhudev's men began to pick off the Georgians, Jeb's soldiers mounted fresh horses and struck out to rejoin the fight. Within hours, The Mongols had completely destroyed the Georgian army and the small nation's aristocracy. Subadem made the country a vassal state, the first in Europe, and it proved to be one of the most loyal and supportive Mongol vassals in the generations ahead. With this test complete, Subadeh and Jeb set out down the mountains to explore the plains of Eastern Europe and see what the rest of these unknown people were like on the battlefield. Systematically, but persistently, the Mongols probed the area. With the usual emphasis on reconnaissance and information gathering, they determined the number of people, the location of cities, the political divisions, and the rivalries among them. The Mongols found some Turkic tribes, known as the Kipchak, living on the plains between the northern shores of the Black and Caspian Seas. The Kipchak practiced a herding lifestyle, very familiar to the Mongols. Playing on their similarities as fellow dwellers within felt walls and speaking related languages, the Mongols learned much from them and enticed some Kipchak to join them as allies. The real object of Subadeh's interest was in the agricultural lands farther north and west. The area contained many cities, and although all shared the Orthodox religion and the Russian language, rival and ambitious lords ruled them. Subadeh moved his forces toward them to see how they would respond. He reached the banks of the Dnieper River, north of the Black Sea, at the end of April 1223. The Christian cities of the plain managed to unite enough against the heathen invaders to send out their armies. Hastily assembled troops set out from all the small kingdoms and city-states of the area. Smolensk, Galich, Chernigov, Kiev, Volunia, Kursk, Suzdal, and some of the Kipchak. Three of the armies from Galich, Chernigov, and Kiev came under the command of princes, all of whom were named Mstislav. The most impressive of the three Mstislavs was Prince Mstislav Romanovich of Kiev, the largest and richest of all the cities, who arrived with the most impressive army, including his two sons-in-law. As the Russian armies gradually trickled in, the Mongols sent an envoy of 10 ambassadors to negotiate a surrender or alliance. The Russians haughtily executed them all, without any awareness of what a serious breach of Mongol diplomatic etiquette they had committed, and what a high price their princes and all Russians would soon pay for their crime. The Mongols began the confrontation with a small skirmish, after which they immediately began to fall back toward the east, from whence they had come, as though they might have been afraid to fight such a large and powerful foe. The Russian troops and some of their Kipchak allies gleefully followed them. But day after day, the Mongols remained a little beyond the reach of the pursuing Russians. While some of the regiments had not yet arrived to join the pursuit, the slower regiments fell behind, and the faster ones raced on, nipping at the heels of the fleeing Mongols. The Russians feared that the Mongols might escape, and thereby deprive the Russians of the large number of horses and other booty they carried from their earlier raids across Persia, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. In the competition for glory and loot, the Russian princes began pushing their soldiers on to get the glory of being the first to attack the Mongols. But in a crucial mistake, they made no plans for an organized retreat, regrouping, or withdrawal. After nearly 2 weeks of chase, the vanguard of the Russian army finally caught up with the Mongols on the Kalka River, which empties into the Sea of Azov. And here at last, they would force the invaders to fight, at the place Jeb and Subadeh had selected as most advantageous to the Mongols. Without pausing to allow their men to recover from the long forced march, and in fear that the Mongols might escape once again, the confident Russian princes drew up the battle lines for attack. The later chronicles varied greatly on the number of Russian soldiers present, but somewhere between 40 and 80,000 men fought on the Russian side. the Russians fielded at least twice as many soldiers as the Mongols. But the Russian soldiers had been recruited mostly from the grain fields and small villages of the countryside. They were peasants who, when healthy and properly nourished, were quite strong and experienced in episodic campaigns. But they could scarcely be considered a professional army, particularly at the end of winter, when they were poorly nourished. Most of them had more expertise in swinging a scythe to cut hay or cracking a whip to spur on an ox than using the weapons of war. Yet assured of easy victory by their aristocratic officers, the peasants lined up dutifully in military ranks behind their shields. Each man carried whatever weapon he had found or adapted from his farm tools. A makeshift sword, spear, mace, or club. A smaller number of better-trained archers stood nearby, and the elite officers proudly perched atop their steeds in the rear behind their infantry. The Russian soldiers braced themselves, standing solidly shoulder to shoulder, unsure what kind of attack would come, but they remained determined not to break ranks. But the attack seemed not to come. Instead of attacking, the Mongols started singing and beating their drums. And then, just as suddenly, the Mongol rank fell into an eerie but absolute quiet. Since it was a clear spring day without too much dust, the Mongols had chosen a silent attack, to be controlled and coordinated by the waving of flags, at which signal the mounted Mongol archers raced silently forward toward the Russian infantry lines. The pounding of their hoofs on the earth reverberated across the lines and into the legs of the nervous soldiers waiting for the brunt of their charge. But the opposing sides failed to clash. The Mongol horsemen halted just beyond reach of the Slavs' hand weapons, and from there, the Mongols fired their arrows straight into the Russian infantry ranks. All around them, the Russian soldiers saw their comrades falling in pools of blood. Yet they had no one within reach to counterattack. They had no one with whom to have a sword fight. No one at whom to throw a spear or chase with a club. All they had was a barrage of arrows, and the Mongols had purposefully made the arrows so that they could not be knocked onto their adversaries' bowstrings. In their angry frustration, all the Russian soldiers could do was break the fallen arrows to make sure that the Mongols could not retrieve them to use again. With their infantry cut to pieces, the Russian archers took aim and began to return the volley of arrows. But with the shorter range of the less powerful European bows, few hit their mark. In mockery, the Mongols chased down the Russian arrows. But rather than breaking them, they fired them back at their original owners, since the notches of the arrow easily fit the Mongol bowstring. The stunned Russian forces quickly began to fall back in panic. The Mongols followed them, picking them off one by one as they would a herd of fleeing gazelle or panicked deer. As the retreating Russians bumped into the columns of soldiers that had not yet arrived, they began to fall over one another, jamming the route of retreat and increasing the chaos and the slaughter. The mounted princes of Russia sat astride their massive war horses with their shiny javelins, glistening swords, colorful flags and banners, and boastful coats of arms. Their European war horses had been bred for a massive show of strength, to carry the weight of their noble riders' armor on the parade ground. But they had not been bred for speed or agility on the battleground. In their heavy metal armor, the Russians normally had little to fear on the battlefield from other European aristocrats mounted on similar show horses. But with their infantry routed all around them, they too had to flee. But beautiful as their horses were, they could not carry the heavy loads for long. The Mongols overtook the iron-clad warriors and one by one killed the reigning princes of the city-states of Russia. The Mongols continued chasing and slaughtering the Russians all the way back to the Black Sea, where the campaign began. In the words of the Novgorod Chronicle entry for 1224, of the large army sent out to fight the Mongols, only every tenth returned to his home. For the first time since the attack of the Huns on Europe nearly 1,000 years earlier, an Asian force had invaded Europe and utterly annihilated a major army. At the end of the campaign, Subadah and Jeb led their soldiers down to spend a relaxing spring in the Crimea on the Black Sea. They celebrated their victory with a great drunken party that lasted for days. The guest of honor was the defeated Prince Mstislav and his two sons-in-law. But their treatment showed how much the Mongols had changed since the time of Genghis Khan. The Mongols wrapped the three of them in felt rugs, as befitted high-ranking aristocrats, and stuffed them beneath the floorboards of their gur, thereby slowly, but bloodlessly, crushing the men as the Mongols drank and sang through the night on the floor above them. It was important to the Mongols that the Russians understand the severe penalty for killing ambassadors. And it was equally as important for the Mongol leaders to reaffirm to their own men the extent to which they would always be willing to go to avenge the unjust killing of a Mongol. Although the chroniclers of Armenia, Georgia, and the trading cities of ancient Russia recorded the appearance of the Mongols, they were totally mystified as to who these people were and where they went when they left. The chroniclers interpreted their own defeat at the hands of these strangers as a punishment from God. Since the Mongols did not stay to occupy the land, but continued on their trek back to Mongolia, the Europeans quickly forgot the Mongol victories and returned to their own squabbles. In the Christian interpretation, the Mongols had fulfilled God's wish to chastise the people, so God sent them home again. As explained by the Novgorod Chronicle, the Tartars turned back from the river Dnieper, and we know not whence they came, nor where they hid themselves again. God knows whence he fetched them against us for our sins. 12 years after Subadah's first victory over the Russians, participants at Ogoday's Hurultai reviewed the information about the earlier Mongol victory. Ogoday's primary interest was the wealth accrued from the European campaign, not the battle tactics. Despite the stunning victory on the battlefield, the expedition had produced little loot compared with the Chinese or Muslim campaigns. Because Subadah's force had not had time or the numbers to organize a campaign against the walled cities, they had brought back little. But his reconnaissance revealed that there were many cities. More important, during their rest to fatten the horses in the Crimea, the Mongols discovered trading centers manned by the merchants of Genoa, some of which the Mongols had raided. Ogoday seemed to dislike and perhaps mistrust Subadah, and the feeling seemed largely mutual. Subadah's position was most strongly supported by the family of Joch, who lived in the far western steppe, and had inherited the lands conquered by Subadah around the Volga River. After Joch's death, he had been succeeded in the office of Khan of his lineage by his son Bot. As the second eldest and one of the most capable of Genghis Khan's grandsons, Bot Khan was in the best position to be elected Great Khan when Ogoday died. And a campaign against Europe would add greatly to his wealth, prestige, and ultimate candidacy. For much the same reasons that Bot wanted the campaign, Ogoday Khan resisted it. He personally stood much more to gain from a campaign against the Sung. In his position at the center of the Mongol Empire, the lands of two of his brother's families separated him from Europe. But only the land of his youngest brother Tolu lay between him and the Sung dynasty. Conveniently for Ogoday, only 3 years earlier, in the fall, when the most fermented mare's milk was available. 40-year-old Tolu had staggered drunk out of his tent one morning after a drinking binge and dropped dead. Ogode immediately moved to annex his dead brother's property, which included the ancestral